Hello and welcome to Science World. The solar energy market is growing rapidly, so scientists are looking for more inexpensive and environmentally friendly ways of harnessing the sun's power. We've talked about the problem of the growing amount of space debris a number of times on our program. Now, the European Space Agency is stepping in and planning to do its part to solve this potentially dangerous problem. And a geophysicist and a seismologist recently found new evidence that deep beneath the surface of our planet lies what could very well be the largest reservoir of water on Earth. We'll talk with one of the researchers to learn more about their studies and the evidence for their findings. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. The global solar energy market is expected to double from $38.5 billion in 2009 to more than $75 billion by 2016. As the market grows, so does the potential for making solar cells in such a way that reduces environmental risks. Roseanne Skirbel tells us more.
Many of the solar panels you see on rooftops use special materials called semiconductors, such as silicon, to generate electricity. However, silicon is not especially good at absorbing light, says Jonathan Major, physics professor at the University of Liverpool in England.
To absorb a useful amount of sunlight with silicon, we would need to use around 200 micrometers of material. For absorbers such as cadmium telluride, we need to only use around 1% of the same amount of material.
Which is why cadmium telluride is now firmly established as the market standard for making the next generation of solar cells. It results in more flexible panels and dramatically outperforms silicon, with one major drawback.
The problem is that cadmium chloride itself is a highly toxic compound. It's carcinogenic, it's been linked to genetic defects, and if it gets into the water supply, it can poison fish stocks for generations.
That's why Major and his colleagues started looking for alternatives to cadmium chloride, the crystalline compound used in the solar cell manufacturing process. As they report in the journal Nature, they found that magnesium chloride is an efficient, low-cost, and harmless substitute.
It's simply recovered from seawater. And it's currently used in a number of applications, such as it's used to salt roads in icy conditions. You can buy it as a health supplement or a mineral bath soak. And it's also used as coagulant for the production of tofu.
Major has filed a patent on the manufacturing process using magnesium chloride, but says it will take time for the industry to adopt it.
And the only reason we can say as to why no one has is simply that cadmium chloride works very well, and it's seems to have been a case of if it isn't broke, no one's bothered to fix it. So, I mean, for myself, I've worked in cadmium telluride solar cells for around 10 years now, and cadmium chloride has always just simply been viewed as the process. That's the one you use, that's how you make the solar cells, and no one's really varied from that.
Major will continue to refine the process for its potential in the solar industry. He adds, the work is a good example of the important role academic research can play in industrial established technologies. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
NASA's Mars rover Curiosity recently sent a selfie it had taken of itself back to Earth to mark an important milestone. This past Tuesday, Curiosity completed its first Martian year on the Red Planet. Now, a Martian year is equal to 687 Earth days, just 45 days shy of 2 Earth years. Curiosity's selfie was taken at one of the locations where it drilled into Martian rock back in April and May, called Wingenna. NASA says that so far the Martian rover has traveled 7.9 kilometers in its planned journey to Mount Sharp inside the Gale crater since it touched down on Mars in August 2012. Security experts say that those who defend computer systems need to be able to hack them to understand their weaknesses. Michael Sullivan reports from a cyber boot camp in San Diego, California, where tech-savvy youngsters have been learning to hack computers.
About 20 high school students, top contestants in a local computer competition, are learning to hack at the office of the IT security firm ESET North America. 16-year-old Chloe Chrysostomo is taking part in the five-day program.
We set up networks and then we can hack into the network or we can hack into other people's computers and then mess with them.
A single data breach like one last year at the retailer Target can cost hundreds of millions of dollars as financial institutions are forced to cancel and reissue compromised credit cards. The problem is worldwide, and police in places like India and Romania are struggling to keep up with the cyber criminals. A recent industry study projects that data breaches worldwide will cost more than $350 billion this year. Hundreds of billions more are spent to prevent the attacks. In San Diego, these students are seated at computers in what is called the War Room. They learn about cyber spying and the online marketing of stolen information. Security researcher Cameron Kemp says the cyber camp has a realistic IT system.
Set up very similar to what would be a typical corporate environment. So whether you have Wi-Fi, whether you have corporate networks that store company information, we actually replicate that.
It is a closed environment, and students learn how to hack it. Recent high school graduate Jomari Salomon says the workshops help him understand the minds of criminal hackers.
To learn how to defend against a hacker, you have to know how a hacker attacks or how a hacker thinks, or to be able to defend that kind of vulnerability that you're probably going to have in the future.
The 18-year-old plans to join the U.S. Air Force and specialize in computer security. Liz Frauman of the nonprofit foundation Securing Our E-City says the high schoolers change their attitude through the week of training.
When we look at them initially, they think they know it all. They know a lot already. And by Wednesday, they're going, I don't know quite as much as I thought.
Security expert Cameron Kemp says by week's end, the students are well-versed in white hat hacking and have learned to help not harm computer users.
And we would like to say that we convince these folks who are skilled computer people that the rewards in the end are much better for working for the good guys rather than the bad guys.
Those in the growing field of computer security say they need more young people like these to counteract the growing numbers of criminal hackers. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, San Diego.
Coming up on our one-on-one segment, we'll talk with a geophysicist who recently found evidence of water deep beneath the surface of the Earth. So, with the structure of Earth in mind, it's time for the Science World Quick Quiz. Of the four major layers that make up Earth's structure, what is the layer that lies beneath the first layer, or the crust, called? Is it A, the inner core, B, the mantle, or C, the outer core? Good luck! We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Scientists say the increasing number of space debris circling our planet is threatening functioning satellites as well as humans flying into space. In this report by George Butich, Science World's Doug Bernard tells us how the European Space Agency, or ESA, is planning to solve the problem.
The U.S. space agency NASA says there are more than 500,000 pieces of space debris, with more than 20,000 larger than an apple. Most are speeding along at about 7 kilometers per second, or more than 25,000 kilometers per hour. At that speed, the impact of even a cherry-sized piece of metal is enormous, says deputy head of ESA Space Debris Office Holger Krog.
At this velocity, both objects will shatter into pieces. This will be bad for the object concerned, but it will also be bad for the rest of the environment because we will add additional fragments, which again then are candidates for future collisions.
Scientists monitor the path of space debris and sometimes reposition satellites or even the International Space Station to avoid collisions. But ESA's Holger Krog says keeping track of the orbiting junk requires powerful sensors.
The U.S. Space Strategic Command is in possession of such sensors. It's a relic of the Cold War to detect approaching missiles. And it is a global network of radar and telescope stations on ground observing space continuously all over time.
Loss of a communications, GPS, or a scientific satellite could have potentially devastating effects, so scientists are exploring options for removing dangerous debris.
That means planning a mission that goes there, approaches, rendezvous, and captures the object, berths it, and then does a controlled deorbit maneuver. This is a very, very complex technology that will be required for that.
Several designs are in consideration, such as a satellite that fires beams of charged particles that gradually slow down flying objects, dragging them into the atmosphere where they will burn up. Smaller objects could be shot down with ground-based lasers, while larger ones that break up into thousands of smaller pieces may be brought down with special robotic satellites. Even though such missions could cost up to $200 million, Krog says they should start as soon as possible to prevent the chance of larger collisions that could send many thousands of additional pieces on their deadly flight around the Earth. For George Pudich, I'm Doug Bernard.
According to a new study, people who are low in the sunshine vitamin, better known as vitamin D, appear to be at higher risk for developing high blood pressure, known as hypertension, which is a risk factor for heart disease and diabetes. Jessica Berman reports.
Researchers led by University of South Australia nutritionist Alina Hooperin conducted a population study of nearly 150,000 Europeans looking at two genetic variants that reflected their vitamin D status. Investigators found people with a particular gene had more vitamin D and a reduced risk of high blood pressure.
And I think that this is a potentially very important finding because it's likely that by avoiding vitamin D deficiency, we can also lower the risk of developing hypertension.
Hypertension or high blood pressure is a risk factor for heart disease and diabetes. Studies have shown that vitamin D deficiency may play a role in the development of autoimmune diseases, including multiple sclerosis. This is the first study to strongly suggest its link to hypertension. According to the Vitamin D Council, those at highest risk of not getting enough of the nutrient include people with darker skin, those who spend a lot of time indoors, people who live in northern latitude countries, seniors, pregnant women, and those who are overweight. Hooperin says blood tests for vitamin D are expensive and not routinely done. So to make sure you're getting enough vitamin D, she says spend some time outdoors.
We can be pretty confident that we don't have severe problems with vitamin D deficiency if we are exposed to some sunlight and we don't use excessive amounts of sun lotion, and also if we are consuming vitamin D fortified foods.
Such foods include salmon, wild-caught mackerel, mushrooms, cod liver oil, tuna, sardines, and dairy products such as milk, cheese, yogurt, and eggs. In addition, Hooperin says it could not hurt to take a vitamin D supplement between 400 and 1,000 international units each day. The study linking vitamin D deficiency and hypertension is published in the journal The Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
On our last edition of Science World, we spoke with Mike Halpert from NOAA's Climate Prediction Center about the weather anomaly El Niño. Lisa Schlein is reporting that the World Meteorological Organization is now saying that the world can expect hotter, drier, and wetter weather toward the end of the year.
El Niño is characterized by unusually warm ocean surface temperatures in the central and eastern tropical Pacific. It recurs at 2 to 7 year intervals and has a major impact on the climate around the world. World Meteorological Organization Climate Prediction and Adaption Branch Director Max Dilley says sometimes these conditions can be quite extreme.
You have parts of the world which experience drier than normal conditions as a tendency. During El Niño years, you have other parts of the world which tend to get wetter. You have parts of the world that tend to get hotter and parts that tend to get colder. So the effects can vary depending on which region you pick.
The World Meteorological Organization says it expects this year's El Niño to reach the same levels of strength as the last El Niño from 2009 and 2010, which was the hottest year on record. The World Meteorological Organization expects the El Niño to peak during the last quarter of this year and into early 2015. It says it cannot be sure how intense it will be, but expects an El Niño of moderate strength. Max Dilley says the socioeconomic impact on regions affected by these extreme climate events can be powerful.
So, for example, when you have a drought, one of the sectors which is very often affected is agriculture. It also can affect water supply, and water supply could mean irrigation for agriculture, or it could mean water into a reservoir for hydropower generation. You can have floods, of course. They affect infrastructure. They can flood housing. They can cut off transportation links, wash out roads, block bridges, etc.
These climate conditions, he says, also can have serious health impacts, such as outbreaks of cholera and other waterborne diseases. It can increase the incidence of malaria. Dilley says a number of international organizations are using WMO advanced El Niño warnings to make plans to blunt its impact. For example, he notes the World Food Program is prepositioning food in areas that might be difficult to reach in extreme weather conditions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Let's check and see if you've got the right answer to this week's quick quiz. Of the four major layers that make up Earth's structure, what is the layer that lies just beneath the first layer, or the crust, called? Is it A, the inner core, B, the mantle, or C, the outer core? The answer is B, the mantle. The four major layers of the Earth's structure from the surface and down are the crust, the mantle, the outer core, and the inner core. The crust goes down from Earth's surface down to between 5 and 50 kilometers, which marks the beginning of the mantle layer. The mantle is about 2,900 kilometers thick and is followed by the outer core. The outer core is about 2,266 kilometers and is followed by the very center of the Earth, which is called the inner core. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet, voanews.com/science.
A pair of researchers recently reported some new evidence that indicates that there are possibly oceans worth of water deep, deep, deep beneath the surface of the Earth. While this deep earth water isn't in the form we're used to, such as liquid, ice, or even vapor, the researchers say that their discovery still just might be representative of our planet's largest water supply. Steve Jacobson, a geophysicist from Northwestern University, along with University of New Mexico seismologist Brandon Schmant, have found their evidence of water within pockets of hot magma that was found about 645 kilometers beneath North America. Jacobson and Schmant say that plate tectonics may be responsible for driving water so far down into the Earth. Steve Jacobson joins us for today's one-on-one segment to talk about the research he and his colleague conducted and the huge possible water supply that lies deep beneath us. Now, when you're talking about the mantle, I realize it's one of the layers of the structure of Earth. What is the mantle exactly?
The crust of the Earth extends down to about 40 or 50 kilometers depth, so maybe 25 miles. And the difference between the crust and the mantle is compositional, so the rocks in the crust are a little different from the rocks in the mantle. We have some idea of what the rocks in the mantle are like from samples brought up by volcanoes. However, I should note that the deepest hole ever drilled in the crust is probably around 10 or 12 kilometers depth, so maybe 6 miles. And the mantle extends all the way down to the core mantle boundary, which occurs at about 3,000 kilometers depth. So the mantle makes up a huge amount of the planet, about half the planet's mass. is in the mantle, which is a rocky silicate layer that is, for the most part, solid, except for a few places, like in this layer that my colleague Brandon Schmant and I have been studying, where we found evidence for a small amount of magma generation at that depth, at 400 miles depth.
What is the link, then, between magma generation and this water?
We're trying to connect the rock cycle, which some people know as plate tectonics, with the water cycle. Now, we know in the uppermost mantle and the crust and the mantle are interacting through plate tectonics. For example, the ocean crust contains hydrous minerals, both in the form of sediments on top, but also the ocean crust itself, which is largely made up of a rock that we call basalt, can become hydrated through interaction with seawater. In places where plates are coming together, one plate sometimes dives down into the mantle beneath the other. This is a process that we call subduction. And in subduction, water is taken down in the form of minerals, and they typically don't make it very far. Within the upper 100 kilometers or so of the mantle, the temperatures become so high and the pressures become high enough that those hydrous minerals begin breaking down to form other minerals, but in doing so, they also release some H2O. And this process is called dehydration melting. And it's actually the source of magma in all of the volcanoes you would see, for example, in the Ring of Fire. If you look at a globe at the Ring of Fire, you may also notice that there's a subduction zone alongside nearly the entire Ring of Fire. So this is the upper mantle water cycle, and we wanted to ask the question of how much deeper could this H2O cycle extend into the mantle. And this is not a new idea. I would say going back to the 1980s and possibly before, but in particular I'm thinking of work by a professor at the University of Colorado named Joe Smith, who was looking at the structure of high-pressure minerals that we think should exist deep in the mantle. One in particular we call ringwoodite. And what Joe Smith predicted, theoretically, was the ability for ringwoodite to absorb huge amounts of water in the form of OH, that's called a hydroxyl group, into its crystal structure. And this mineral exists in this layer, which we call the transition zone, which extends from about 410 kilometers depth to 660 kilometers depth. So we've kind of been on the lookout for this deeper reservoir. And by reservoir, I'm talking about a geochemical reservoir of H2O. We've kind of been on the lookout for a couple of decades.
When you're hearing news about that there are oceans of water found deep inside the earth, you have this visual image of huge masses of water. But from what I understand from what you're describing, Steve, is that it's not in a liquid or an ice or even a vapor form. So what form is it in?
The water is dissolved into the solid rock in the form of hydroxyl, which is an OH group. It's locked up in the minerals in this way. However, I should note that by having the components of water inside of rock at this depth of the earth, it's very significant. It's connected to the oceans and the surface reservoirs through plate tectonics. So if you were able to bring up one of these rocks from the deep mantle, from 400 miles depth, and melt it near the surface, the OH would regroup and form water molecules and come out of a volcano in the form of water vapor. The source of water, if you will, in magma generation and eruptions, which release huge amounts of H2O and other volatiles like carbon dioxide. We think the deep water, the deep H2O, and surface reservoirs are connected. They're certainly connected in the shallow mantle. You know, you can probably recycle all of the water in the oceans through the upper mantle once every 100 million years or so, and that's just based upon current seafloor spreading rates. We don't know much yet about this deeper reservoir, which could be potentially as large as the oceans or maybe even more than that. We don't know how much of this water is part of that upper mantle cycle versus it being maybe somehow more isolated or trapped in this transition zone layer.
That was Steve Jacobson, a geophysicist at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog, voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.